from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Stare at a painting on the wall. No matter how long you wait, it's not going to tell you what it's about. To find meaning in the spattering of paint, you must step back, gaze from many angles, and consider the brushstrokes. For philosopher Alvin Noe, the process of interpreting art is a useful metaphor for a broader understanding of how we grasp the world around us. In his new book, Varieties of Presence, Noe explores the many ways we use knowledge and skills to achieve a presence for the world and our thoughts and our perceptions. Forum is up next. He'll join us in studio after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this hour of our forum program. Alvin Noe joins us in this forum hour to discuss his most recent book, Varieties of Presence, published by Harvard University Press. He's professor of philosophy at the University of California, Berkeley, and has also been distinguished professor of philosophy at the Graduate Center of the City University of New York. He's also the author of Action and Perception and Out of Our Heads, and joins us here in studio for conversation this hour. Good to have you back here on Forum. Welcome.
Good morning.
Good morning. This is a formidable book, but it's an important book and deeply philosophical. I'll even use the word phenomenological, and we'll get into these ideas and make them, I hope, generally understandable, because I couldn't help thinking, I was reading your book while I was traveling in Spain and going to galleries, going to Prado, going to the Picasso Museum. What part of the book is about, I know your next book is on this same trajectory, is how we look at art and how we look at art applied to our perception of how we look at the world, really.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So tell us, okay, I'm looking at a painting. What should I be looking for and how does that affect my perception?
Well, what I'm interested in, you know, when you're writing philosophy, if you want to tie it to a phenomenon, to an experience, to something we all know, and I find that there's a phenomenon and experience that we all have when we go to look at art that is really very concrete and specific. And I organize this book around this to help sort of fix ideas. And the experience is this. Suppose you go to a gallery. It might be the Prado and you might be looking at the great classics of art, or it might be something very contemporary and avant-garde. But suppose it's work that you don't know. Suppose it's work in a style that you don't know. I think all of us have had the experience that you walk into the gallery and, well, you just don't really get it. All the pictures look the same, or none of them particularly jump out at you. Maybe, you know, it's like faces in a crowd.
Or there's just a red line across the canvas with all white against it.
But I'm actually talking less about something to do with the content of a picture as the fact that all the pictures are kind of indistinct. None of them particularly reveal depth or seem to be anything more than surfaces on the wall. And it can be very tempting to simply be bored and leave. But sometimes we have the experience of not doing that, of deciding, no, we're not. We're going to actually spend some time and ask some questions and look harder at these things around us. And sometimes, not always, we're not always so fortunate, sometimes a remarkable thing happens. Whereas all the pictures looked the same, all of a sudden they pop out at you with sort of distinct physiognomies, distinct personalities. Whereas before they all seemed flat, now it's as if they have hidden meanings that are available to you. Whereas before they didn't capture interest, now they can be fascinating, even moving. And so I'm very interested in that phenomenon, which many of us have experienced, probably all of us, maybe in music, in any other domain, where we move from not seeing or not getting it to getting it, to seeing, or to seeing from seeing to seeing differently.
I'm reminded of a line by Adrienne Rich where she said, what we see, and seeing is changing. I mean, this is where experience plays its role, as opposed to just trying to take something in, let's say, or be, well, responsive and reactive to something.
Exactly. So and I'm interested in this transformation and in thinking essentially, as you say, about it as a key to understanding what experience is. What is it that happens that enables us to go from not seeing to seeing, that enables us to bring into focus this thing which is right there in front of us? I mean, it's really an amazing thing. The picture hasn't changed. I'm assuming we're not dealing with new media stuff, which might actually be changing. But if you're looking at pictures on the wall, they're stable. They're not changing. So if there's a change, it's a change in you. But it's not just a change in how you feel or how you think. It's a change that really enables you to make contact with these things that are there, these objects, these creations of a human being, and bring them into focus. And in a way, what I think that this example reveals is the way in which, you see, I'm talking about art, but what interests me is how this is really a metaphor for thinking about experience in general.
Perception.
Well, by experience, yes, perceptual experience, the way the world shows up for us in our lives. This is the phenomenon I'm interested in, the presence of the world, your presence to me now, the presence of my voice to our audience, the presence of this chair that I'm sitting on. They show up for me in my life. And in a way, what I want to argue in this book is that they don't show up for free. We achieve the presence of the world around us by, as for example, in this case in the gallery, active looking. So what do we do? Suppose your friend says, you know, look at that red line across that white canvas, and ask yourself, is that a picture, or is that not representational or depictional at all? Why is it in a gallery if it's not a picture? Well, do all artworks need to be pictures? And did you know that at the time, I'm just now fantasizing this, did you know that at the time that painting was painted, what most other people were doing was this, or this person's teacher was doing this, so this is actually a response to that? All of a sudden, by thinking, talking, sharing with another person, this thing that was flat and indistinct becomes really a source of interest. And, you know, if you walk into a party and there's a ton of people, you have trouble seeing them all at first. It's just a kind of a crowd. But through interaction, through looking, through questioning, through probing, we actually bring the world around us into focus.
And it all becomes contextual, or it all becomes individualized, or it all becomes somehow part of our experience and therefore the world, the presence of the world as we understand it. I mean, yes. I like the idea, and yes. It goes back actually to other work of yours. I mean, I was reminded of the last time you were on Forum, and I was thinking at the time about an interview I did many years ago with Francis Crick, who said, well, we're all neurons. Mm. And thinking, no, Professor Noe says maybe there's something neural pathways are just a part of the whole picture. Mm. The real understanding has to be, at least for consciousness, with what happens not in the brain like the digestive system, but what happens in the whole gestalt.
Mm. Yes, Francis Crick, who is such an important biologist and did very foundational work in the neuroscience of consciousness, he wrote a book which he called The Astonishing Hypothesis. And his astonishing hypothesis is this. He said, you are your brain. You're nothing but a collection of neurons and their associated molecules going snap, crackle, pop. That's what
you... So a lot of neuroscientists say.
That's really the dogmatic view. The funny thing is that Crick thought it was an astonishing view. He said, and this is a quote, he said, this idea is so strange to the way that most... This is a paraphrase. This idea is so strange to the way most people alive think today that it can truly be called astonishing. But of course, the thing which is really striking is how astonishing it isn't. This is really an inherited idea we have that you are something inside of you. Descartes thought that thing inside of you, which is what you are, was your spirit, was your soul. Crick and the contemporary neuroscience establishment thinks that the thing inside of you, which is the thing you are, is your brain. All of them share, this whole tradition shares this idea that when we're interested in mind, we're interested in something going on inside of you, something that's disconnected from the rest of the world. In fact, the world is nothing but a field of patterns of neural stimulation. And by trying to set thinking about perception and consciousness as I do in this gallery example, I'm trying to show that actually we're always already in an environment, in a situation, and our ability to perceive is really our ability to obtain access to the world around us. And like everything else we do, that depends on our background and our knowledge and also on the availability of other people, for example, who coach you how to see the picture.
Which means we're not necessarily like John Donne, to use one of the allusions you make, you know, islands unto ourselves. But there is a lot of subjectivity in terms of how we interpret and how we experience the world.
Well, John Donne said, no man is an island unto himself. And the sort of the dogma of contemporary neuroscience is that every man is an island.
Yeah, exactly. So you're more with John Donne. These presences that you talk about isn't about representation in terms of what's in our head. It's all about actively achieving access. It's all in the experience then, huh?
Well, in a way, the term experience is not one we can take for granted here. In a way, what I'm really asking is, what is experience? And I'm suggesting in this book and in actually in all of my writing that experience is the activity of achieving the world's presence. Or to put it differently, it's the activity of achieving our presence in the world.
In the world. Mm-hmm.
You know, the neuroscientist says, where in your brain is the experience happening? And I say, that's like saying, where in the muscle is the dance happening? The dance is not happening in the muscle. Just as the value of the money in your pocket isn't in the composition of the bills itself, the value has to do with the unfolding dynamic exchange that money enters into. The dance has to do with the dynamic exchange between you and your environment in time through movement. And likewise, experience is a transaction. It's an ongoing engagement. Now, don't get me wrong, please, listeners. I'm not denying that the brain is necessary for all of that. We all know about how damage in the brain can produce tremendous deficits in human experience. We also know that when you have experience, things are happening in your brain that enable that experience. But the brain is not alone sufficient for experience. But in a way, this book is really trying to suggest, just ask you to think about this. The world shows up for you. The world is present in your thought and your experience. Right now, my mother, who, if I'm lucky, is listening to this broadcast over the internet in New York, my mother is present to me, not as visually present, but she's present to my mind, to my imagination, to my thought. How can she be present when she's so far away? Well, she's present because I have access to her. Right now, I could pick up the cell phone in my pocket and call her. So presence for me is access.
The world
and access
is achieved
is based on
rather
skill.
Than given, I think is how you put it.
Yes, experience is achieved, and we achieve the world's presence in our experience. Think about this. You walk into a room, and there's writing on the wall. And you don't see marks and figures on the wall. You see the meaning. You see, you know, do not smoke. That's what you see. And then it's the meaning that pops out at you. Of course, it can only pop out at you thanks to what you know, thanks to what you know how to do, thanks to the fact that you participate in this very complicated skill-based capacity to read. And so reading then opens up the world and makes it available to you. But let me take it back to the visual case, if I may. Like right now, all our listeners can do this for themselves, and you and I can do it here. Just think about your visual experience now. Right now, you're in a cluttered environment where there maybe are other people and there's furniture and there's objects and there's all sorts of things of meaning and significance to you. Maybe you're at home. Maybe you're in the car. Here you and I are sitting in the studio. All of these things are present to you. The question the neuroscientist asks is, how does the brain give rise to all of that in your head? How does the brain give rise to that detailed internal representation of all of that? And I say, wait a second. Hold on. That's the wrong question to ask, because notice, it doesn't actually seem to you as if all of that is there for you in your head. It doesn't seem, you know, some things are in focus, some things are out of focus, some things are in the background. The detail is there. It is present in the world, not in your head. And the modality of its showing up in your experience is that you have access to it by moving your eyes, by turning your head, by reaching out, by picking up, or by, in my previous example, exercising your ability to read.
This is where you also get into what you call the serial motor. I mean, how important movement is as part of this, taking in
the sensory motor.
Yeah,
yes,
sensory motor.
Yes,
yeah.
That's right. That was really the central theme of my first book. Every time you move, you produce a sensory event. When you blink, you disrupt the stimulation of your eyes. When you turn your head, you alter the way in which your eyes are stimulated. So whatever else is true about seeing, whatever else is true about seeing, it's true that people who see need to be sensitive to the ways in which their movement alters their sensory experience without getting confused by it, without it's disrupting them. So I had this idea, which actually I developed with the French cognitive scientist Kevin O'Regan, that really what seeing is exploring the world, making use of an understanding of the way our own movements affect our relation to the world. And we called that sensory motor knowledge, and we talked about the importance of sensory motor knowledge and experience. And that, by the way, is what got the dancers interested in my work, and what sort of got me into this dialogue with the arts, because dance, of course, is precisely a field in which the focus is the way in which skillful movement makes things happen. Skillful movement makes experiences.
You call this the inactive view of experience, what you're talking about here?
That's what I called it in my first book. Yeah. I should say that that term got me into a little bit of trouble. I chose that term to pay homage to Francisco Varela, the great Chilean neuroscientist and phenomenologist and Buddhist, an acquaintance of the Dalai Lama, and really one of the scientists who first tried to bring sort of a richer conception of what experience is into connection with neuroscience, a sort of, in my book, one of the really good guy neuroscientists. And he had died shortly before my book was published, and he used the term inaction. He talked about the inaction of experience through engaged dynamic exchange, brain, body, world. And so it was sort of an homage to him. But of course, my view isn't exactly his view, so I've gotten into a little trouble that what's the difference between Varela's view and my view, but that's academic shop talk.
We're talking, if you've just joined us, with philosopher and author and professor UC Berkeley of philosophy, Alvin Noe. His book is Varieties of Presence. And on the cover, and let's talk about this. There's a painting on the cover, Apples and Fingers, painting by Alexei Worth. You want to communicate something here, don't you, on this cover about what you're talking about?
Oh, wow, that's a really great question. Alexei is a painter I admire. He's also a friend. And for years I've wanted to sort of collaborate with him by having him do the cover of a book for me. He's a painter who is extremely interested in painting as a heavy-duty intellectual modality of research, a way of really thinking about the history of painting and the history of our relation to the visual world. So this is actually on the cover of the book. It's a detail from a still life. But of course, what the still life is actually a hand setting up the apples, which will then be the subject matter for the still life, which sort of, if you like, is happening off camera. So the picture shows the way in which we compose our experiences. And it's true of the artist. The artist composes a painting. But each of us, skillfully, through how we position ourselves and move and through the reliance on our expectations, composes our experiences.
Makes it seem like we're all artists again, which is something we all like to believe, or at least potential or putative artists. Style is a very important part of this, in fact, really, isn't it?
Yes, thank you for mentioning style, but let me just first pick up on your observation. You know, one of my sort of inspirations is the work of John Dewey. And John Dewey had this idea that, in a way, what experience is a circular, transactional, fluid process of doing and then undergoing, acting and sort of being acted upon or being affected by the consequences of one's own action. He had this picture of all experience, whether at the level of the animal or the human being, as this kind of this
basis for pragmatist thinking.
Yeah,
really.
Yeah. And then, of course, what is an artist doing? But an artist is precisely, if you like, in the small, sort of in the context of a particular project, something that the artist is making, is precisely, to use the word we used before, enacting experience. So the painter puts a stroke on the canvas, and then, having put the stroke on the canvas, sees what the stroke looks like and steps back and makes another stroke and then sees and makes and sees and makes, always seeing and making with an eye also to what this would, how this would be seen or how this would be available to another.
Always? I mean, because a lot of artists say, no, I don't think about what others might think or what I'm communicating on the canvas. It's just what I have to let out of myself.
I guess I would make a distinction between the psychological question of what the artist is actually thinking about or consciously entertaining when they work, and the question of what the project of making pictures is. And I grant that many artists might just think of themselves as expressing, but they're expressing, I think, in a shared intersubjective space that is available to others, and it's essential to what they're doing that what they're doing is available to others in some sense.
The work of art, therefore, becomes philosophical?
Yeah. So I gave this gallery example of the way in which we bring the work of art into focus through conversation, through looking, through thinking, through interrogating the work of art. And I said that experience of the work of art is, in a way, a metaphor for all experience. That is, we can take that example as a launching pad for investigating human experience more generally. But that example also, I think, gives a beautiful clue about why art is so important to us. And that's a question that really interests me. What is art and why does it matter to us so very much? And that clue is this. When you suppose it's the case that all experience is a matter of achieving the world's presence, the opportunity you are afforded when you're in the gallery or when you are engaging a work of art, which of course needn't be in a gallery, it could be any old place, the opportunity that you afforded is the opportunity to catch yourself in the act precisely of moving from not seeing to seeing, of bringing the world into focus. So in that sense, the experience of art or the opportunity of art is the opportunity for a kind of revelation about the situation in which we find ourselves. And what better characterization of the aims of philosophy is there than that? And I think that the work of art in some profound level, and again, whether or not an artist consciously believes this about their work, but I think a major source of the significance of the work of art is that the work of art is philosophical. It's revelatory of that which is taken for granted or implicit or unquestioned in our normal perceptual or cognitive or religious or spiritual or sexual or whatever they might be encounters with the world around us.
Avinoé with us here in studio. The world shows up not to our eyes or our brain, but to us, I think, is sort of an encapsulation of what we're talking about here. And we certainly welcome your thoughts about this. I mean, it's really a bigger subject of consciousness, but also about art and how we perceive art. And I'd like to hear your thoughts. In fact, we welcome them. Our toll-free number is available, and you can call us now at 866-733-6786 should you care to join the conversation. You're cordially invited to do so. Again, our toll-free number, 866-733-6786. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or post any questions or comments you might have on our website by going to kqed.org/forum and clicking on the segment, or going to our Facebook page. A number of ways of course, communicating to us your thoughts and your perceptions. Where does the whole question universality fit into your configuration here? I mean, you know, you can maybe begin to think solipsistically or in terms of individual perceptions being not necessarily related, but art gives us, we like to think, universal things that we can map and we can connect to.
You know, that's not a word I use, universal.
Use archetypical then, or use, you know, yeah. Critics come away with often totally antithetical perceptions of a work of art, but some can be grounded in the very similar view of a work of art, obviously.
Yeah. You know, one of the things I think is so interesting is that when people have differences of opinion about works of art, they believe it's necessary to discuss them further. That is, it's not like, oh, you find this tasty and I find it, you know, repellent. As we might say about certain foods.
No, I don't want to say I'm right and you're wrong.
I had a friend over last night who doesn't like red beets, and I love red beets. I found it difficult to understand how she couldn't like red beets, but there are people that don't like red beets, and that's the end of the conversation.
It's me, by the way.
Oh, okay.
Sorry.
Probably many of our listeners. But if you don't like Barnett Newman, or if you don't like Neil Young, and I love Neil Young and love Barnett Newman, well, gosh darn it, that's a subject for us to pursue further. We can't.
But that's taste, isn't it? It's opinion. It's as opposed to maybe what we perceive and what we are affected by from what we perceive.
Well, the interesting thing about art is that as I, in a way, my gallery example shows, is that really what we're doing when we think about and talk about and look at works of art is figuring out what it is we see and changing what we see through the conversation. So I don't think, you know, you might think there's art, which is this sort of thing unto itself, and then there's the work of critics talking about art. I actually think that criticism is an essential aspect of art.
More when we return. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Professor Avinoé with us in studio this hour, professor of philosophy at UC Berkeley, where he's also a member of the Institute for Cognitive and Brain Sciences and the Center for New Media, and has been nominated for Guggenheim 2012. Congratulations, Alma. Also, we'll be appearing September 20th at the University Press Books place in Berkeley. We're going to try to find out. They changed their name. It's
on Bancroft.
Yeah, well, we'll try to get the new name of it for people who may want to come out and turn out to engage with you and see you and hear you. By the way, speaking about seeing you and hearing you, I want to bring our callers into this. But I went back and read some more of your stuff, including an article you did back in 2006. And with this whole Melky Cabrera scandal, and I mean, it's gotten even broader now with I'm talking about the ball player for the San Francisco Giants who was caught red-handed using substances. And it's become even more exacerbated by the fact that apparently they bought a website and tried to fake the fact that he was drawn in by this website. It's a whole mess. But what I want to get to is an article you did back 2006 where you said, don't ban blood doping. It shouldn't be a principal difference in terms of separating athletes who should compete and should not compete. In fact, I think you compared blood doping to carbo loading or high-low altitude training and said shouldn't be prohibited.
Yeah, that's actually my.
It's not quite like red beets, but I thought.
No. Yeah, I mean, this is a change of pace. But I'm happy to discuss this because in some ways, I think it goes to the heart of the themes that are present in my book. I'm really interested to go back to John Donne and the idea that no man is an island. We're all everything that we
or woman.
No, excuse me. I'm just quoting Donne. Yes. Of course, he has no man or woman is an island. Each of us is part of, is at home in this complicated world that we live in. And what we can do, what we can achieve has everything to do with the situation in which we find ourselves, the nutrition that we have been given, the love and support that we've been given by our parents that have enabled us to be able to learn and grow and achieve and be successful. I think one of the reasons why sports interests us, there's many reasons, and I happen to actually be a rather avid sports fan, is that sports is a context in which we can really look at human achievement and look at human at the failure to achieve and think about what it takes. For me, the guys who are doping, in some profound sense, are not really cheating. Now you might say, wait a second, if they're actually taking a banned substance, then they're cheating by the letter of the law. And of course, I agree with you 100%. If they break the letter of the law, they should be found guilty of cheating. But the question is, why do they keep doing it? There's every reason to believe that doping is very widespread, and there's every reason to believe that in this arms race of the regulators trying to catch the dopers and the dopers always one step ahead, why are they constantly doing it? And the reason is, And by the way, in amateur sports and professional sports, I think the reason is that in their heart of hearts, athletes don't really think of it as cheating. And I'll say why. What you're trying to do if you're an athlete is optimize yourself, it's not to win. I mean, there is winning, and there are huge financial benefits connected to winning that we have to also bring into this conversation. But if we put that aside, at some fundamental level, you're trying to do something that hasn't been done before. And so you think about how you should sleep and how you should live, and maybe you meditate and you work out and you study scientifically your nutrition and you use computers to study your mechanics and you have coaches and you travel around the world to get the best advice and the best training, all in the interest of making yourself the best performance vehicle you can be for this particular task. Now, that's a very extreme thing. But where do we draw the line? What's the principal distinction between, you know, the use of advanced biochemistry to modify your diet and your sleep and your oxygen intake and forms of manipulation of your biochemistry which are considered somehow cheating? Just as a little, by the way, when I ran track in high school for 1 year, and I never remember the coach talking to us about, you know, the spirit of sports, but I remember on the very first day we met, he talked about, you know, lactic acid buildup in the muscles and the pain it caused and the way that diet and stretching could be used to minimize lactic acid. In other words, from the very first day, his focus was on taking control of your own biochemistry and controlling it and manipulating it. I think it's very much in the spirit of sports to do that. And I think our refusal to accept that shows that we have a kind of conflicted set of attitudes in this area.
Well, there's also the moral question that figures into this calculus. If people use steroids, are they giving a wrong message to youth? And, you know, you have to kind of factor that in as well. But I just wanted to get you on the record on that because it caused a lot of controversy when you wrote that piece.
Yeah. Well, let me just respond to you that, though, and I think this is important. We romanticize sports. And the thing we forget is that sports, as played at the most advanced competitive level, are not good for you. I mean, I'm a baseball fan, and baseball players have multiple surgeries, and they have, you know, lives ended with arthritis and weak knees and
Hell, that's worse for football with all the head injuries now, I'm afraid.
Of course. But so if I was the father of a child eager to get into sports, I would be very concerned about his safety. And so steroids is just a further health risk on top of the other risks. And by the way, if the performance-enhancing drugs were legal, maybe they could be applied in a way under medical supervision that made them less dangerous, less harmful, rather than more. But I'm not an expert on that side of things.
Well, we've got a lot of callers who want to join us and talk about what we talked about in the first segment, and let's go to them. We go first to Santa Rosa. Gregory, you're on.
Oh, hi. Yeah, this is a great show. Thanks, Michael. It sounds like about 80% Zen here with the presence question. So I wanted to say, first off, we're not like all islands. We're all like funnels in a stream or whirlpools in a stream where this great soup of vibration washes into our sensory fields, and then it's the internal vibration is responsive. So there is no firm boundary between. So in the question of presence, my question is, are you talking about a presence that solidifies or reaffirms the subject and object, the inside and outside? Are you talking about a presence that transcends or sees through the inside and outside subject-object dichotomy?
Wow, that's a great question. That question is right on the money.
Well, give us your best definition of presence. You know, people use it and use it widely, and you're talking about it in terms of agency.
So, I mean, and I really want to address the caller's point. By presence, I mean something that we experience. I'm talking sort of from the perspective of our lived experience. I mean, the presence of your voice to me now, the presence of the room that I'm in to my consciousness, the presence to my auditory system right now of the sounds of the air conditioning vibrating in the room. The world shows up for us. That's the thing we want to understand. And I want to explain it precisely by saying we're embedded in the world. We have these skills. We are, in some profound sense, attuned to and at one with the world exactly in the way that you suggest, caller. But what's crucial is that I'm trying to appeal to that integration of the human organism with the environment in order to explain our experience. And our experience does tend sometimes to have a subject-object structure, if you know what I mean. In other words, you know, here's this this microphone in front of me that I can see. It shows up for me. I don't mistakenly think that the microphone is me and I am the microphone. On the other hand, it's precisely thanks to the fact that the microphone is there and I'm here and that we are coupled together in an environment in a certain way that I can experience it.
Let me thank the caller for that. And in fact, you know, when I think about presence, that word, I think about Yeats sometimes, and I think about spiritual mundi, presences he writes about in some of his poetry, as if there are presences that we can't feel, we can't experience. I mean, we can't bring through conscious or rational perception, but are there. And you talk about manifest presence, and you talk about fragile presence, and mm-hmm. you talk about presence in varieties. And again, without getting too academic here, I mean, why do you break it down in that tripartite way?
This idea that presence is fragile, I think, is it's actually one of the ideas in the book that I'm most excited about, and I'm not sure I fully have yet plumbed its real significance. But go back to the sports analogy. Think of a baseball player in the outfield shagging fly balls. The ball is present to him. How? Thanks to the fact that he is continuously moving, running, adjusting himself to try to field the ball. And of course, it's an ever-present possibility that he might fail to field the ball, that he might drop it.
Or so, might misjudge where it's going to fall, or where he could catch it.
In other words, the just as when you're hiking on a trail, you have to work hard to maintain your footing, and the possibility of losing your footing is a live one. It's a real one. It's not a sort of a merely skeptical one. So all of the ways in which the world shows up for us in perception or in thought are susceptible to potential failures. And what I think, I actually find that a liberating idea. You see, the great Western tradition that we're part of somehow says, look, you don't really see something unless it's completely represented in your head. But wait a second. When you see something, all you ever get is a partial glimpse of it from a particular perspective. You can't see the hidden parts of the things that you see. So seeing something is always just a matter of kind of it's a work in progress to achieve access to it. And I find that a very, actually a very liberating idea.
Let me go to more of our callers here. But before I do, you mentioned fragility, but I guess it's rather obvious when you talk about presence in terms of it being manifest, because you've pretty much made that clear. But yeah. Also, well, and I guess it's pretty clear about what you mean by the variety of presence. I mean, it's everywhere. It's the world. So the variety can't be discounted in any way.
Well, the variety is important because consider, you know, I come into the room, I sit down here and I look at you. So you're showing up for me sort of at the focus of my attention. I'm talking to you now. But now consider the way in which the walls of the room are present to me. They're not sort of focally the object of my attention, but they're there for me nonetheless, but in a different way, in a different modality, I would say. And I think we can also contrast between the way in which the world shows up to vision and the way it shows up to taste and the way it shows up to thought and the way it shows up to imagination. So the presence comes in all sorts of flavors, in all sorts of modalities. And what I try to do in this book is actually offer an account of the varieties of presence, the way in which what explains the different qualities of our experience, the variety in the experience, are, and to use a topic you mentioned before that I forgot to continue with, are the different styles of skillful exploration of the world.
And the book, again, is Varieties of Presence. And the next caller is Diane. Hi, you're on.
Hi. Well, this is going way back to near the beginning of the program, and you were talking about how people perceive art in a gallery and maybe shift into perceiving and being more aware and their perception changes. And I happen to have, I think it's almost the opposite experience of how that happens for me. It does happen. But I go in and I'm first sort of in my verbal monkey brain, busy mind mode, and I might be looking, they look like surfaces on a wall, even wonderful pictures. But then if I go, stay there like you suggest and keep looking and wait, what happens is my mind and my verbal side, which is very verbal, quiets down, and I start perceiving things in a much less verbal, what feels like a more visual and what we used to call a right brain way, which was just not the model anymore for the brain. But and then I start to have emotional body connections and feelings and responses beyond just intellectual as well. And sometimes I have a beautiful, rich experience, and I can just feel myself shifting out of my usual verbal gear. And it's best if I go alone because I don't want to discuss it and talk about it. I don't want to hear people chatting about it. I get into, you know, what I'd call art mode, which sounds a little different than what you were describing.
Oh, that's a beautiful observation.
That's very well rendered. But I'm also thinking about in your book when you talk about, you know, you can be in a gallery and not necessarily hear the chattering, but maybe not avoid the fact that somebody is interpreting a painting mm-hmm. that you're looking at, and you're not necessarily seeing that way.
Right,
and
the museum docent is walking by yeah. and talking about it. You know, what I would say is that I think that actually we're very much in agreement, what you just said. I do have a tendency to describe things in pretty intellectual terms, but I didn't mean to suggest that the sort of the dynamic activity of investigating the work of art has to take an explicitly verbal or, if you like, top-down rational quality. But I'm interested in the fact that, as you beautifully describe it in your case, something happens and a transformation comes about and you're doing something and the work is doing something to you and maybe you're doing something to the work. And there's a lot to be said about what that transformation is. And I'm interested For the purposes of trying to draw conclusions about perception in general, I'm interested the way in which your background knowledge, your understanding, your expectations, and indeed your language do influence that process. But of course, there might be emotional levels that are of a sort that are much more difficult to do justice to in words.
Diane, we thank you for your call. I want to go to some of the web comments that we've been getting. Sam writes, the history of society and our individual lives is an essential part in ourselves as a subject, but art is meant as a thing of value in itself, despite our desire to see the art as a thing in itself. The artistic tradition is what informs the viewer about the artist's intentionality. Does Alvin Noe have any contributions as to the role that the historical artistic tradition plays in constructing the experience of the phenomena of a work of art and the possibility of viewing the work objectively?
I'm not sure I understand all of what is presupposed by that question, and I feel that there's that's a structured question with a very clear point of view, and I'm not sure I quite get it. I think that I sort of think that all art has, you know, going back through the ages, has had an interest in, if you like, subverting and challenging what we normally take for granted when we engage in our transactions with the world. So you get the newspaper and there's a picture of the chicken on sale, you know, and the advertising supplement that comes with the newspaper, but you don't approach that picture of the chicken as a work of art, even though it's actually a quite remarkable creation of human artifice. When you go to the gallery and you look at a picture, and again, I don't mean to presuppose that art is somehow confined to the gallery space, but when you encounter a work of art, everything is put into question. What is a picture? What is presupposed by seeing things in a picture? What is the intention or aim or value of pictures? When there's a religious depiction, what sort of assumptions are made about our attitudes to what is depicted? By the way, this term presence I'm using, as Michael indicated earlier in reference to Yeats, has a long use in connection to religious ideas. So, you know, is Christ present in the Eucharist? Or an example I discuss in the book is, are the characters on the stage in a theatrical production present to you? And if they're present to you, how are they present to you? Are they present sort of symbolically? Are they present to you in the way the actors are present to you? You know, you're in the same room as the actors, but are you really in the same room as the characters?
Or I've always been drawn to a phrase of Derrida's, the presence of absence. I mean, actually, I don't even know if it was originally his. It may go back to James Joyce, but the idea of what you feel, for example, when someone who was alive is no longer alive, or what you feel when you're not in a place where you have been, but that place has changed, and all of those kinds of things, call it nostalgia or sentiment or even just memory, there's a presence of absence.
Yeah, there's the presence of absence, but there's also a remarkable kind of presence in absence. And you can think of that like, for example, think of the presence in your experience now of the room down the corridor. Now, you can't actually see it. In that sense, it's out of view. It's absent. And yet it is still in the scope of your consciousness.
Another listener writes on the website, Laura, mindfulness, paying attention, listening, focusing on the moment, it will change the way you experience the world. With all due respect, I would say the world is not dependent on your reading or understanding. I would offer emptying your mind of your efforts to interpret the world and experience it without preconceived notions. You want to comment on that?
Well, in some sense, I'm very much in sync with that. I think of experience as a kind of openness to the world. And indeed, if you think in terms of, as the previous caller said, the kind of monkey chatter, noisy brain life that we have, sometimes opening yourself up to the world requires shutting down. But I want to say that at a more fundamental level, experience is active. It's achieved. It depends on what you know how to do. At the simplest level, your ability to move your eyes and turn your head enable you to visually pick up the world around you, just as your ability to reach out and grasp something in your hands enable you to pick it up in your hands. And that's, by the way, why education is so important. That's why learning language and mathematics and arts are so important, because when you learn new skills, new techniques, new methods, new worlds open up. And by the way, notice that I'm not saying that when you read, you don't concentrate on the shapes of the letters. Once you read, you can fluently enter into the world that is being written about. And likewise, when you can see, you don't need to think about shapes and colors and forms. You can see another person, a human being. You can see a dog. You can see a sunset. And so in a way, the ability to have a quiet mind has to do with a kind of a tuning up and a cultivation of oneself So in some ways, I think that the kind of the idea of mindfulness is very much in sync with what I think is what we're doing in our perceptual consciousness quite generally.
Avinoy, here with us in studio. His new book, Varieties of Presences, and our next caller, Art, is with us from Berkeley. Hi, Art.
Hi there. I'd like to say something about something that I feel is missing from the broader cultural conversation, for example, around religion and spirituality versus materialism, and I'd be curious to get the guest's comments on this, and that is that the materialists and, you know, the cognitive scientists that you spoke of earlier would be in this camp. They basically have a position that seems to me to be epistemologically untenable and is kind of, you know, bad philosophy in that sense, like that they assert that there is only the material world as a kind of a priori. They can't really disprove that or prove that, yet they act as if they can. And I'm really curious about why the guest thinks that that's sort of left out of the conversation around, religion and spirituality.
Thank you for that. I'm gonna answer you slightly indirectly because I don't quite want to get into the discussion of religion. But the way I would frame it is not in terms of materialism, but in terms of thinking about what is nature, what is natural. These days, if you want to study love or if you want to study art, the fashion is to look at it in the key of neuroscience. You know, what is functional magnetic resonance imaging tell us about what love really is, or why art is important to us? And what I have come to believe through a long time worrying about these questions is that actually the neuroscientist, and by the way, some of my best friends are neuroscientists, but that the neuroscientist doesn't actually have an adequate conception of the natural world, an adequate conception of our own nature, of our own biology, and that we need a much more contextual, dynamic, non-individualistic way of understanding what a human being is. And by the way, one of the reasons why I'm so now interested in the dialogue between science and philosophy and art is because I actually think that far from its being the case that neuroscience may help us sort of unpack what art is and why it matters to us, it may be that art will help us better frame a conception of what we are and thus help give neuroscience a better foundation.
This may be time to do something about the old Snow-Levis controversy and bring science and art or science and the humanities together in some convergence.
And it's absolutely happening. I mean, when I was a graduate student studying philosophy, it quickly became apparent that those guys, you know, in the other building working in the neuroscience department or in the AI department, artificial intelligence, that they were really also doing philosophy. They might not have known that's what they were doing or wanted to call it that. They were doing philosophy. And not only that, they were doing it in sometimes better than we were doing it over in the philosophy buildings. So I'm sort of part of a generation of philosophers of mind and consciousness who have always had a kind of active collaboration with people working in the sciences.
You said, some of your best friends.
Some of my best friends. But what's happening now is that we're seeing all over the world and in every area of the arts, we're seeing an interest in the arts in collaboration with science. I'm part of a Dance Engages Science working group in Frankfurt, Germany, and this is really going on everywhere. Partly because artists are hungry for information about us that can be material for their work, but also because I think scientists are increasingly recognizing that work in the arts is actually a form of research. That's not all it is. I don't mean to reduce it to research, but you know, if you're working as a choreographer, you may be investigating the nature of consciousness and the way it depends upon movement, for example.
Melissa writes, can Dr. Noe comment on how his theory may relate to the effectiveness of advertising and its influence on how we invest objects with meaning?
Oh, gosh, that's a really big, really big...
It is big,
Big question. I will say that that the power of images in the popular media over us is so astonishingly great. I mean, I don't think there's any of us that really can have a sort of sense of of ourselves.
Do you remember the old famous book by Vance Packard, Hidden Persuaders, about all that subliminal effect that advertising supposedly has on our perception and our consciousness? That's something that's difficult to quantify, but it's there. Its efficacy is there.
No question about it. And in a way that maybe this is what the author of the email has in mind. If you agree with me that experience depends on a dynamic interaction between sort of brain, body, and world, then one way you can manipulate experience is by manipulating the brain directly, but the other way you can manipulate experience is by manipulating the world, is by constructing environments. And, of course, that's what stores and advertisers do.
I always think about those old cigarette advertisements, which are no longer permissible, where they have people, you know, on an island and they're making out and they're beautiful people and they seem to be, you know, completely absorbed in each other and in love. That's the notion somehow that will be your world if you smoke the cigarette. I mean, that's the subliminal and maybe the obvious. So you mentioned dance a few times, too, and there's a sense here that, and we've mentioned Yeats a few times, there's a sense here that I can't help thinking about. You can't tell the dancer from the dance, is what you're saying. Everything's organic in how we experience.
Mm-hmm. In some ways, for me, dance functions in my work in many different ways. One way it functions is as a metaphor for experience. I think of experience as a dance between the organism and the organism's environment, his or her environment. But dance also functions for me at another level. Dance, thought of as an art form, choreography, I want to say really can be a kind of philosophy, a kind of cognitive science.
And dance is also being human in many ways. It's a great metaphor for life, as Zorba taught us. You know, when you do the dance of life, you're experiencing the world, and the world is coming into you, and you're getting access to it, as you write about.
Well, one of the interesting things about dance, when you are caught up in a dance, you are organized. This is a term in my new book that's very important. You are organized by the dance. Your music, your rhythm, your body, your relation to the environment around you, to the person maybe you're dancing with, all of it gets entrained by this dynamic, which is the dance. And all of us are all the time organized in that way, not only in dance.
Good note to end. Avinoy, thank you for being with us.
Thank you very much.
The book, Varieties of Presence. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, and our repeat at 10 to 11 in the evening. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll, and our producers are Judy Campbell, Tina Lauberg, and Amanda Stupai. Our engineer is Danny Bringer, and Forum's executive producer is Raul Ramirez. For all of us here at KQED, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.